We're going to start. I hope everybody's back. I'm Sheila Shaver, another of the organizers and the chair for this session. Democracy assumes some degree of equality in the rights and the voice of its citizens in the way in which they're governed. And this session is about what economic inequality means for the polity. What does it mean to be the citizens in a democracy in which people's resources are unequal? And we have two papers to talk on this subject. The first one is going to be given by Brian Head, and he's going to try to show us why the policies addressed to inequalities are so particularly difficult to resolve, why, in what sense they are wicked problems. Brian is professorial fellow in public policy and management at the Institute of Social Science Research at the University of Queensland.
Good afternoon, and thanks very much for inviting me. I'll get straight into it. I have 35 minutes maximum and quite a few ideas to cover. I really want to talk about how the policy system works and about how policy ideas about inequality come and go over time. There's no doubt that we have vast amounts of information and much better information these days than we did when Ronald Henderson was starting his pioneering work. But what we do with information is another story, and that's really the policy story and the politics story. It's not at all clear that the series of policy ideas that have come through over the last 30 years have resolved the problems that everyone acknowledges as being important. And I want to suggest some fairly obvious things in the half hour I have. One of them being that the way we think about the problems is a matter of social and cultural and political framing, and that a lot of politics is actually about the way different groups of people have framing contests about what counts as a problem, how we scope it, and how we should respond to it. And they always do that, of course, in terms of point three here, some kinds of value frames, but also the history of the issues concerned. I want to suggest in the middle of the talk that one way of thinking about big, very broad intersecting issues like economic and social inequality it can be viewed through the lens of the wicked problems literature. And I'll spend 5 minutes talking about what I mean by that and how that might help or not help our thinking processes. But one of the things that comes out through that literature is ways of thinking about complexity and interaction, but also about why solution making is always a political and contested matter, and why the solutions that we arrive at are provisional and not in any sense fixing the problem in a long-term sense. And so history and context and institutions and the political system are all incredibly important, but the basis for policy change and adaptation is always there. So we've heard this morning that there are lots of problems, that international organisations from the World Health Organization to OECD to the United Nations and so on are all scoping out what are the big issues facing the globe and facing the developed countries through the OECD group. And I find it interesting that the OECD, as a kind of policy think tank for the member states, is doing some quite interesting work on crises and managing crises, presumably as a result of real world challenges that are facing member states, issues about health and disease, issues about social cohesion, issues about economic stability, violence, climate change, and a whole heap of other things, including forced migration as a result of various kinds of disturbances. The poverty agenda has always been there, whether it's called social exclusion, poverty, inequality, social fragmentation and so forth. The OECD report, Divided We Stand, that came out a couple of years ago, which I'm sure you've all read, makes the point that levels of inequality in the developed countries have generally worsened. In other words, the Gini coefficients have shifted over time. Widening income disparities in the last decade or so, and that on the whole, the taxation systems have had a weaker redistributive effect than previously. So in the last 10 years, there seems to have been some turning around of the story of progress that we perhaps become a bit used to. One of the things I find interesting about OECD is it vacuums up sort of consensus ideas about what is good policy. And the four messages I got from that report were quite predictable ones in many ways. Employment growth is key thing. Jobs is the way that translates. Investment in education has always been a big thing with OECD, but interestingly, in the last decade in particular, they've added in the importance of early childhood into their human capital story. Then there's a couple of political points, which OECD tends not to get into, but I find it interesting that they are, in a very gentle way, getting into that. They're saying reforming tax and benefit policies to increase redistributive effects is a debate that countries need to have and hopefully resolve some of these tensions I alluded to earlier. And that investing in high-quality public services, in other words, the universal argument primarily around education, health and family care, are incredibly important to provide the kind of social, economic and cultural base from which a civilised community can make its decisions. So it's a turbulent world, not too many answers, lots of data, fiscal constraints. What are we going to do about it? Well, I want to show you two pictures, and I want you to tell me which one is the picture of inequality. One or two, as the psychologists say. And the first box is important because it's a picture of what the wicked problems literature calls tame problems or solvable problems, problems that can be resolved in a satisfactory and agreed way through technical solutions that do the job and fix the problem. And if you know the rules of the game and you have the resources and the skills, you can go a long way to fixing the problems. But most of what we're talking about is more like this. It's basically an incoherent picture of multiple intersecting threads and loops and stuff, where it's very hard to sort out the causality and the interactive effects. And in thinking about these notions of complexity and uncertainty and divergence of views and the way people frame problems and solutions in different ways, I found it quite useful to map that onto a kind of a 3x3 thing where some of the things we want to disentangle are about straight, is it a complex or simple set of links and factors? Is there significant levels of divergence in viewpoints among the people concerned, the actors, the stakeholders, and so forth? And the uncertainty point is largely about the knowledge base. And it's possible to crudely allocate low, moderate, and high levels of uncertainty, of complexity, uncertainty, and divergence. And if you get some high scores, that's what wicked problems are supposedly about. So the old Ritalin Weber article from 40 years ago, I think, actually makes some sense. And just as an aside, I just came back a couple of weeks ago from the 40-year reunion conference for the Wicked Problems Mafia at Berkeley, where it all started in the early 70s. And they are still full bottle on this. They think it's really, really good, and they're trying to apply it to a whole range of issues. We'll come to that later. Just to remind you, the key features of this approach is to say that the old blueprint rationality type planning is dead and buried, and people shouldn't try and resurrect it. wicked problems characterized by divergence, uncertainty, and complexity are inherently difficult to define and will always be contested in that sense. That Webb diagram suggests that there's lots of interdependencies, complex causality, very hard to do simple program evaluation where pulling one lever in a randomized controlled trial clearly shows that certain effects happen, and then we can go out and implement that more broadly. Probably divergence among stakeholders, probably entrenched value differences. The problems themselves tend to be elusive and keep evolving under our eyes, so it's not a fixed problem that we can get to grips with. It's morphing and changing over time, and the knowledge base, both about the problems and possible solutions, is patchy and dispirited. So the wickedness bit is where those circles intersect. It's about where complex, divergent, and uncertain things come together. And I think that in thinking about inequality, a lot of these characteristics are on display. We'll come to the issue in a moment of whether that's actually helpful to move our thinking forward. But my first take on this is that if we are saying that socioeconomic inequalities in the forms that we heard about this morning are in fact complex, value contested, and have an uncertain knowledge base, maybe there are no solutions in the traditional sense. There is a temptation for political leaders to indulge themselves with symbolic and ideological gestures in the face of these problems, to the extent that they become a matter of public attention and require visible action, then the tendency to engage in symbolic and ideological responses is very high. The third point is just about the knowledge base. Many of the risks, interdependencies, and trade-offs are not knowable. Responsibilities for solving it, very important point, may stretch across many organisations. So we have issues about coordination, collaboration, mutuality of goals and objectives, and so on and so forth. We have a lot of choices to make about tools and instruments and approaches, and with a strong likelihood that they will need to be tailored to specific situations, as we heard from the Indigenous education talk earlier today. No one size fits all. We need a mix of approaches. And in solving some of the problems, it's not just about regulation. It's not just about better laws. It's also about finding smart ways to influence and motivate and create behavioural change. Let me switch to a topic that many of you know a lot about. Just thinking about how to grow children in a healthy social environment. This is something that I was introduced to by a number of people in this room, including Ross Hommel, sitting there. You can take some of the responsibility, Ross. Sue Richardson, Fiona Stanley, Ann Sampson, and a number of other people, Steve Zubrick. If we want to say here is a child who needs attention because of certain multiple disadvantage, how do we deal with this? How do we even begin to start thinking about it? And one of the most fruitful ways of thinking about it that's come to my attention is the ecological perspective, where you basically map the circles of influence and the circles of institutional impact that need to be thought through in focusing on a particular case, like an individual disadvantaged child or people in a target class similar to that. And so the thinking, the policy thinking over time has moved in more complex ways to recognise that in solving the issue of a particular child, it's necessary to go beyond the child and to look at family function, look at the schooling connections, look at the local communities, and look at the way those institutional arrangements intersect with a whole bunch of other broader macro structures, so that starting from an individual point, you move out in concentric circles and overlapping circles to say this is a complex interactive system in trying to improve the life chances of that person, we need to take into account quite a range of intersecting factors, and that in intervening in one of those circles but not taking account of the others, we may end up losing the game or creating counterintuitive and perverse outcomes of some kind. Steve warned me that it might do funny things, but this is a slide that I borrowed from Steve Zubrick and Sven Silben. Some of you will know. It's basically a map of saying the same thing. If you start in the bottom left-hand corner with a new child, a newborn child, and think of all the things that need to go well to get them into the top right-hand end of the maze where they are active, fully engaged, skilled citizens, there's a hell of a lot of things that need to go well. And it emphasises the developmental pathways. It emphasises the stages of development where there are quite particular kinds of issues that come into play, and the interaction of social and economic and cultural and political factors. And one could do exactly the same thing for other kinds of issues. The intersection between health that we heard about from Fran before, the issues about education, the issues about workplace skills, the issues about family structures and so on and so forth. On the other hand, there are other things going on in the policy system which work in different ways. This is a diagram that many of you will have seen many times, and I apologise if Heckman's stuff is a bit boring these days, but when Jim Heckman came out carrying his Nobel Prize saying, "I have some solutions," people sat up and took notice, because on the whole, people don't go around saying, "I have a solution and I can show you," as a result of decades of statistical analysis, that this holds up. And so Jim came out. I think Peter sponsored a tour, and I think he came a couple of times. One of the things he did was to visit a lot of ministerial offices at state and federal levels. And there was a bit of a breakthrough in thinking and a bit of political momentum built up around the issue of investing in early childhood. And as an article on this said a few years ago, Heckman had a killer fact. A killer fact was this diagram, which purported to show that for every dollar invested in preschool education and care, you got a higher rate of return than in the standard schooling system or in post-school job-related skills training. Now, regardless of whether it's true or not, the power of this message was very profound, and it acted as a kind of a trigger to help change the paradigm about where human capital investment should be directed. I don't want to spend particularly time on the example, but my point is partly that paradigms can change, that well-based research can make a difference, but also that political leadership and selling and marketing are pretty important. And it's in an area where it's not tightly linked to the old sort of rich and poor arguments, though there was quite a lot of that if we went into it. So my argument is that policy is actually about policy framing and winning debates about whose problem is more important and whether there are feasible and credible solutions that will get the government re-elected. We have to recognise on socioeconomic inequality that there's actually a heap of viewpoints. This is inevitable. And part of the Wicked Problems literature is to, I think, draw attention to the inevitability of conflicting points of view on these sorts of matters, not just because of science and knowledge gaps, but because of values, because of people's personal interests and experience, and so on. I've just listed off the top of my head a number of matters on which viewpoints are bound to differ, and that expecting consensus on these matters is highly unlikely. The nature and scope of the inequalities, the potential role of the state. Remember the massive debates about the role of government, which continue to this day. Whether the persons needing protection are deserving poor. I mean, this is not perhaps said in polite circles, but it's certainly a very strong undercurrent in the community. Values about fairness and responsibility that were spoken about in the first session. Policy objectives which cut across that and build on it to do with efficiency, equity, affordability, and no doubt political support. And issues about selective targeting versus universal programs and so forth. There will always be debates about that. And a lot of it has historically gone on in connection with, well, what kind of welfare state are we building? Do we really want a welfare state? People have, to some extent, moved back from that language. I think there's been a series of, for want of a better term, paradigm shifts over the last 40 or 50 or 60 years in this area. I won't go through them by any stretch of the imagination, but the notion that ways of seeing these things have changed over time and solution building has changed over time, I think is actually a very important sort of foundational insight, if you like. And that a lot of the argument has been about the scope and adequacy of social protection, particularly around levels of assistance for those least able to secure their own needs. What we've found since the 80s in particular is the way the welfare agenda in this classical sense of what happened between the 40s and the 70s has intersected very strongly with what's become, I think, the dominant agenda, which is about boosting economic productivity. And that intersection of, or running together of threads has produced some very interesting issues around policy choice. The other thing that's happened, I think, is that the range of target groups or areas for special attention have also broadened significantly over this period of time. I just mentioned half a dozen there. One could perhaps think of alternative ways of phrasing some of those or extending the list. But the general point is we have enlarged our appetite for dealing with issues of disadvantage and building capabilities and building opportunities. That 60 years ago, most of these issues were not there in a forcible way, but they are now. And that says something about the capacity of stakeholders and what someone called the bottom-up movements to actually put pressure on governments, make them aware of the need for new issues, new approaches and so forth. And as far as approaches go, it's a slightly different point. I was just thinking about what are the new policy thrusts over the last, say, 40 years since the Whitlam period. Again, just fairly random examples, but I think the disadvantaged schools programs in various forms has been an incredibly significant new development since the 1970s, and we heard a bit about that this morning as well. A lot of the place-based initiatives to put a series of programs into regional communities or particular suburbs to deal with cumulative disadvantage. Various kinds of economic incentives around skills development and a whole bunch of active labour market programs. A number of people have already touched on welfare to work and issues about encouraging skills, capabilities and self-management. They're not the same thing, of course, but those two things have sat beside each other in recent times. And over time, we get new tools and settings added into the mix. So things are not static. If you take a short-term view, like we've had deterioration in the last decade, okay, that's cause for concern. But in fact, things have kept moving. But on the other hand, there's a lot of stuff that goes wrong. There's a lot of very poor policy design. There's a lot of poor implementation. There's a lot of poor feedback loops and poor political decision making. So where I end up with on this is that we have a range of policy directions that are being contested all the time. We have vocal champions for taking certain things as the linchpin, the capstone of policy to tackle inequality. We have people who would champion health. We have people who would champion education, employment, housing, cash transfers, and other things. It's not that they say this will exclusively fix it, but there's an important and really, I think, interesting policy discourse about, but if you only had one thing you could do, what would you do? What would you give priority to? And people are forced under those conditions to say, well, I'll go for the medium-term solution, I'll go for education, or I'll go for alleviating current distress, which might be cash transfer and getting in some specialist support. But there's always this range of keystone issues in play in an area like socioeconomic inequality. And it's appropriate, I think, that in fact we don't resolve that one. I think it's actually extremely healthy to have a pluralistic set of views about, but what about health, but what about education? And to take the wicked problems diagram, you know, how those things intersect and to make sure that we build intelligently across those issues. So as a political scientist and someone very concerned about the quality of public policy making, I'm very interested in the quality of decisions and of implementation capacities, and not forgetting the importance of experimentation and pilot programs and all the rest, which is the source of a lot of innovation. A lot of the recent literature in policy studies is saying that rational design is good, but is insufficient. We need clever policy wonks sitting in ministerial offices making up policy designs, but we need improved knowledge, which is the role of people like us, more inclusive processes for deliberation, which is involving a wide range of stakeholders and experts who might contribute to understanding the nature of the issues and where we might go next. We certainly need better capacity to evaluate options, but that's not, in my view, a backroom policy wonk type operation. That needs to be a very front of house, open kind of debate, and much better attention to implementation and coordination. If I had more time, I would quote you from a number of conversations I've recently had with powerful people where their interest in that is appallingly deprived. We have got ourselves into a system where we don't think too much about the medium and long-term systems that we're trying to operate. We get focused on running or optimising a system of performance management around preset indicators. And we don't give ourselves the time to step back from that to think about the underlying causes. We tend to run the risk of treating the symptoms, and the symptoms are crying out for attention. I don't step away from that for a second. But unless we also are doing the fundamental systems analysis, we're letting the side down. So evidence-informed policy making, yes. With public understanding and support, yes. We need to do a lot better community education and taking a range of stakeholders into our conversations. I'll make this the last slide, I think. So in summary, problems, I think, from a government point of view, from a political science point of view, are not so much solved, but managed well or managed poorly. This is a way of thinking out loud that I've developed over the last few years. I'm not inviting you to agree or not, but I think it makes more sense to me to talk about managing problems well or badly rather than solving the problems. I think that assessing effectiveness is extraordinarily important, and we need to do a lot more of that, but it is a very difficult task, and political leaders tend not to take it seriously enough to invest a lot of time and money. It needs both time and money. We know from experience that rational blueprints with detailed prescriptions and indicators seldom work. There might be a few cases where it's worked pretty well to take things forward, but on the whole, we need a different kind of set of methods that is much more inclusive and flexible and agile and a few other things along those lines. And finally, I would say it's not exactly let 100 flowers bloom, but it's to acknowledge, I think, that a diverse range of instruments and approaches will need to be used simultaneously. We can't expect a capstone initiative to turn everything around. We need to actually work at several levels. We need to treat the different intersecting problems from their appropriate level of activity, but be mindful of all those connections and try and develop a more fruitful mix over time. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
We have almost 10 minutes for some questions. If we start over there and then to Jeffrey. Oh, okay, yeah.
Thank you very much, Brian. Much of what you say really resonates with some of my experiences. But the one thing you didn't mention, which I wonder if you might comment about, is the dialectical relationship between politicians and policymakers and the popular media.
Yeah, thanks, John. One of the slides I didn't use was on that. It seems to me that one of the things that's changed a lot in the last 40 years since Riddle and Weber's article on wicked problems is that the mediatisation of politics has become a real phenomenon. What I mean by that is simply that all problem identification, problem prioritisation, problem solution making is mediated through the popular media and a lot of populist commentary and ill-informed, prejudicial kinds of commentaries that go on. It has led, I think, to political leaders becoming very gun-shy, very risk-averse, being unwilling to go out and do the hard sell for new policy ideas, except in very rare circumstances. So I think the role of the media has become quite an overwhelming issue in the way policy debates work, and we need to find some better ways of thinking through how to better use the range of media that are available to help develop good ideas.
Jeff, here.
Yeah. Thank you very much for a very comprehensive talk. The philosophy I took away from it is that we must have multi-dimensional package deal policies, but then we've got to persuade our political leaders that they mustn't cherry pick from them, because that unpicks the lot. I think of the Henry Report on Taxation as a good example, but anyone who's thought about combining policies about full employment, getting rid of inflation, equity and so on, knows you have to have a intertwined package deal, and you must make sure that the whole lot is adopted, not just piecemeal or cherry-picked. Do you agree?
Yes, I do, Jeff. I mean, if I had time to think about it, I'd think of one or two examples where that's actually worked quite well. I mean, the only one I can think of just very quickly is the slow evolution of the social accord with the unions in the 80s, where there were quite explicit trade-offs between wages, superannuation, employment conditions, and so on and so forth. And being able to keep that together as a package was critical to their success, and indeed to achieve some of the difficult trade-offs you find in wicked problems around, for example, trying to ensure that you maximise economic growth and productivity, but at the same time be doing a lot of social investment. It's kind of like the yin and the yang thing, that if you can have economic growth, you develop the capacity to reinvest the processes into the kinds of things that we're all concerned about.
Mike, can you, oh, sorry, Marion. And then.
Thanks. Brian, you started by reminding us that there's now vast amounts of information about poverty and inequality and social exclusion. I mean, I think you are mainly referring to information about perhaps the bottom 10% of the population. And, you know, perhaps it's really the top 1% of the population we need to be concentrating on, looking at their behaviour. If we want to galvanise popular support for some of the other things you talked about, such as tax reform geared towards, you know, more effective redistributive outcomes and so on. I mean, you might well say, given your remarks to the previous questioner, that both litigation and the media are going to get in the way of actually publicising that information about the behaviour of the top 1% and their tax avoidance and so on and so forth.
Yes, I mean, to broaden the point, the invisibility of power structures is a major problem. I think 50 years ago there was a bit more what you might call muckraking political economy, showing that powerful elites were doing horrible things in a self-indulgent and cavalier way, and we've stopped doing that to a large extent. I encourage Frank Stillwell to come out of retirement and do something on that. But can you manage that, Frank? I mean, in the US, I'm constantly being bombarded with advice about new books that expose Wall Street and expose the billionaire financiers who have ruined the lives of ordinary people and all that kind of thing. We don't have much of that going on. But even more serious scholarly work about economic elites, there's not much around. The economic historians have done some great stuff. There is some statistical analysis about Gini coefficients and so on, but actually understanding the way the top 1% live their lives and derive their incomes and treat other people would be well worth adding into the mix.
Mike Keating, then I have Jill, and that's probably as many questions as we're going to have time for. But...
Oh, thanks very much, Brian. I must say your talk resonated very much with myself, my own experience as a policy advisor. Just incidentally, I'm wondering how we can really get a debate on the top 1% when the Murdoch press runs 60% of the print media in this country.
Yeah.
That's aside. The question I wanted to ask you is that you've described very well the complexity of dealing with inequality, social exclusion, etc. You've talked about how traditional solutions don't work, and one can see the symbolic grandstanding by way of response. But what my question is, in a situation where you've got to have very much individually specific solutions coordinating a variety of different elements, doesn't that suggest that the services, if I can call them that, really need to be delivered at a very decentralised level? In that context, I wonder if you would like to comment on the role of non-government, highly localised services in the future, and the role of state and perhaps even more so Commonwealth government, which will probably be called upon to finance them, and how such governments would meet their accountability obligations.
Yes, there's some big issues in there. Thanks very much, Mark. I think I detect the beginnings of some policy interest in the value of a more decentralised approach. People have been sort of talking about that probably for quite a long time, but it's quite hard to develop that in structural forms where particularly the Commonwealth is able to let go over some of these matters where it is the major investor. The field of Indigenous service delivery is very fraught, and I'm probably one of the least informed people in the room about this, but I find it interesting that among the many stops and starts in that area over the last 20 years, that there's definitely a thread growing about the importance of a more decentralised approach and a kind of a fit-for-purpose notion of what's important in particular localities, understanding the particularities of different situations, working quite hard with local leadership groups who are empowered to mobilise around particular priorities and to train people up and develop capabilities to allow self-management to work a lot better. So there's a number of examples there which I think are possibly going to be highly productive over the next 10 years. The role of NGOs is an interesting one. I mean, everyone appreciates that to some extent they're caught in different sorts of expectations. On the one hand, government seized the opportunity to outsource to NGOs because they were thought to be cheaper that government didn't have to deal with workforce issues, so that was great as well. They were allegedly, by their nature, closer to the clients than government employees are. So there are a number of advantages of using NGOs, and people like Peter Shergold have gone out on a limb and said that they're also a better source of innovation. So there's a whole series of reasons why delivery through NGOs might be thought to have been, on the whole, a good thing. A number of my best friends and so on work in NGOs, and I think the work they're doing is fabulous. But the problem for government, as you know, Mike, you've said many times, is how do you put in place a system that is pointing in the right direction in terms of setting priorities and ensuring public accountability for funds spent, and at the same time allow sufficient flexibility and adaptation at the local level to be most effective for the target groups. I think that's a sort of an inherent dilemma that we're going to have to work on from different angles for many generations to come. But I'm very positive, very optimistic that we are moving in that direction. And if we can get some more Auditors General on board, that would also help, by the way, if there's any Auditor Generals in the room. We'll talk about that at afternoon tea.
Last question from Jill.
Gillian Callishaw, Sydney University. You talk briefly about, you talk about policies, problem framing, and unspoken undercurrents, and I'm really more interested in the unspoken undercurrents. Seems to me focusing on problems always makes the unequal, the poor, the Aborigines, etc., the problem, so that these categories of people get identified as problems.
Yeah.
The problem is not the inequality itself, and so we don't demand that the super rich answer for themselves, or that overconsumption never becomes a problem in itself. Manufacturing envy that we heard about this morning is not considered the problem. I wonder if you could say a bit more. I mean, there seem to be the serious problems come from the powerful, not from the powerless. So the powerful should be looking at themselves, perhaps.
Yeah, well, thanks for drawing attention to the language issues that are fundamental to this. I mean, I think that's a good point to close the session, because in a way, the way we use language sends signals to whoever the audience happens to be. I mean, I modify my language enormously depending on who I'm talking to. The policy literature conventionally talks about policy problems which jostle for attention, and some of them are agreed to be areas of priority action and governments step in and try to solve them. That's the typical language. There's an alternative language about not so much problems or problem solving, but areas for special attention to achieve various kinds of value objectives or whatever, which is a bit more respectful of the people who are, if you like, the subjects of attention. I won't comment again on the super elites, but I think it's absolutely true that all the work on poverty and disadvantaged families makes the point that you get much better results if you use a strengths-based approach and you don't typecast people as being a problem that other people have to come in and administer.
Thanks. Okay. Thank Brian.